You're listening to Allied Health Podcast, talking all things allied health with your hosts, Danielle Whedon, physiotherapist, and Claire Jones, occupational therapist.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to season 4 of Allied Health Podcast. I'm Claire Jones. I'm a qualified OT. I'm a director at MediRecruit and host of Allied Podcast. The star of the show today is Claire Batkin. Claire is the owner of Your OT Tutor. She has over 15 years of experience and continues to work as an OT. She has extensive experience as a clinical educator. She's a proud OT nerd and has a passion for motorbike riding. Welcome to Allied Health Podcast, Claire.
Thank you so much for having me. I didn't think that the motorbike riding would sneak in there, but my kids would be very happy to hear that, so all good.
It's so impressive, Claire. I don't know of many other OTs out there who've got a passion for motorbike riding, but if there are any out there, please get in touch. We'd love to hear your story too. Yeah. So, Claire, you've recently launched Your OT Tutor, and I came across you on LinkedIn about 12 months ago. I really started to notice your content. I was struck by two things. How great your content is, how practical it is, and how much of it you're managing to push out. You're an absolute machine. It's often a talk of conversation in our office is, how does she do this?
Yeah, it's a lot of work. It might look easy or like, how does she do this? But it was a lot of time, I think, and working to work out the LinkedIn algorithm and all that sort of stuff to actually get your content out there, because there are lots of other OTs doing great content as well, but it's kind of putting in the time to do it every day consistently and finding out what LinkedIn likes and doing more of that to push it out there. But a lot of the things I do try and share are try to be practical, because I think there's going through uni, you get lots of the lecture, lots of the theory, but particularly I think because I do have a passion for helping students and early career clinicians in particular, that's kind of the gap that I see, is that sort of connecting the dots to when they're working practically, what sort of information do they need to know? And I think always being a bit of an educator, sort of over the last decade, I suppose, of my career, it's, yeah, my vibe or my way of doing things is like, how can I explain this in a bit of an easier way for people to understand?
Yeah, and there's so many ways you can communicate information now. So you can capture people when they're sort of taking the tram to work or the train to work, or, you know, listening to a podcast on the way to work. I think you're capturing that beautifully at the moment.
Thank you.
Well done. So, Claire, where did OT begin for you?
So I grew up in a small country town, literally 5 people in my year 12 class in New South Wales. Didn't actually know what an OT was when I signed up for it to get into uni, but somehow found my way into uni. And once I graduated, worked in the public hospital systems in Sydney for about a decade. And probably towards the end of that is when I started to move into doing a bit more student focused work, and started to also do a bit of part-time sessional academic work for one of the universities. And then a few years ago, we moved to Brisbane. And after hiding from the NDIS for as long as I could, because it was still in its teething stages and it just seemed very hard for someone that was in the hospital and not really needing to do it day to day, I was kind of hiding from it, to be honest. But because I wanted to focus on clinical education, I figured that's where all the OTs were heading, which means there'd be lots of OTs that would need to learn how to do the NDIS. So I decided to bite the bullet and do that myself. So I basically went back to the tools, and after doing more sort of educator type role, I was actually back working as a clinical OT in the NDIS in just a private community team, doing a mix of NDIS and medico-legal work, basically just to get my head around how the system works, what the NDIS is like. So it's still like, I still can remember what it's like to be new in the NDIS and to not know anything, which has very much sort of shaped all the courses and the education and the tips that I share on LinkedIn is coming from that. I remember when it wasn't sort of second nature to me and all those sorts of things. So, but then Your OT Tutor came probably nearly 2 years ago, is when I officially launched and started to sort of pop up on LinkedIn and started to do that sort of background stuff, because I wanted to just be able to do education sort of as my primary thing. Launched Your OT Tutor and released my first course probably February 2023, and sort of have just done a series of things since then, with lots of different journal clubs and courses and resources, and just trying to share all the knowledge that I gathered, I think, when I was trying to learn the NDIS with others. So,
Claire, as an experienced clinician, what struck you moving into the NDIS most?
just that there's very particular ways of doing things. Like, you need to write with a certain format or certain words just for it to actually hit the mark. And knowing kind of what information the planners are wanting to see was different. So you could be a really awesome, like, in terms of clinically, as an experienced OT doing some other caseload, like rehab or hospital. But if you didn't have that sort of guidance and support, so I was very lucky, the company I worked in, I had basically went back to like being new grad type supervision. I was doing some shadowing. I had people reading my reports for that first few months, so I knew that I was on the right track. But it was just so much that you don't know, you won't know what you don't know if you don't have somebody telling you, because it's just so different. And yeah, it's so hard sometimes. So you put in a report and you won't hear anything, you won't get feedback straight away for a long time. So it's hard to really improve your practice if without that feedback from the NDIA coming back or somebody else in the interim to tell you that you're on the right track. So that was probably the key thing, is just that difference. And you know, that, and there's no easy answers either. So it's not like you can just Google something and you'll get one answer. You can't even join one of the great OT Facebook forums and put a question and get the same one answer. You'll get five different answers from five different OTs who will say, yep, this worked for me. And they'll all have their reasons for why it worked or didn't work. So I can just imagine, as someone like an early career clinician, that's a very hard sort of idea to navigate, is that there's no right or wrong answers. There's so many inconsistencies as well.
And I think that there's a lot that's a tad negative that can be said around working in the NDIS. But there's also like the NDIS role, the community-based NDIS role is a fantastic role, isn't it? As OTs, we're out in people's homes, out in the community, we're seeing what motivates them, what goals we can set with our participants to achieve the best outcomes of therapy. What other great benefits do you see in this role?
Yeah, no, definitely. There's so many, and you're kind of already heading towards what I think, and it's developing those core skills. So, and you get to develop so many different things. So, whether it's just being able to talk to clients and their families, you get to do so much of that. You get to develop all your assessment skills using standardized assessments and more observational or interview-based assessments. You get to learn how to do lots of equipment prescription generally, depending on what your caseload is. So we're thinking more like a lot of early career clinicians will go into a general sort of mixed caseload where they could be doing a little bit of everything within the community. So there's lots of opportunities to develop skills across the board, which they can then transfer really to any sort of caseload. If they wanted to go into something different down the track, they're developing all those really core skills and being able to think like an OT. Which, yeah, there's lots of opportunities, because that diversity means that you can sort of learn those skills across a range of areas and working with different clients.
And we're talking to therapists day in, day out who are often looking for a new opportunity. And I'm forever pointing out the how valuable the experience you gain from working in a community NDIS role is, and those transferable skills. Once you have those skills, you can lead your OT career in so many different directions. And also, that's sort of focusing on moving out of NDIS, but moving, there's so much career progression available and lots of different directions that you can head in now within the NDIS. And those core skills that you're picking up in those early years put you in a great position to advance a career in NDIS as well.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I came from the public hospital system, and the reason I kind of left is because there was so much more opportunity to almost shape my own role as an educator in the NDIS. But then there's also, you know, sometimes in the public hospital system, you might be waiting for somebody to sort of retire from their position to get one of those senior positions for so long. Whereas in the NDIS, there are opportunities for you to sort of become a senior or team leaders quite quickly. Good and bad things to that as well. But there's lots of that opportunity, and it's a lot of the positions that OTs will be working within the NDIS in the next sort of 5 years probably haven't even been created yet. And there'll be new sort of ways that, OTs can really say, this is what I want to be doing. Can you make it happen? Because the private sector has that flexibility and sort of there's no strict sort of, big organisational type rules that you're working within.
Yeah. We also see people headed towards, the clinical specialty roles, management roles within NDIS or quality assurance as well. And I think that point you make about that hospital system back when I was practicing, that was really the only career progression there was available to step out of clinical work and into a management role. But now the beauty of the NDIS is that there's actual senior and management roles within quality assurance, within being a clinical specialist. So you've got that opportunity to actually, if you love clinical work, you can move up the ranks in that clinical direction and not take on a team lead role and not manage people.
Yeah, definitely.
Great. And it means you're also getting really good people in those roles as well that are passionate about what they're doing.
Yeah, and I mean, there's lots of participants on the NDIS that we're seeing that have quite complex needs as well. So we do need those really senior clinicians that want to stay on the tools really and doing those that day-to-day work with them to help give them the best service that we can.
And what are the challenges with this NDIS role, Claire?
Yeah, well, I suppose it's probably the flip side of that, all that diversity and that opportunity to do things and learn things can be sort of a negative as well in terms of the speed maybe at which that is presented to you. So if you start a caseload and you've got a little bit of everything from day one, that's a lot of brain space that you need to hold to be able to learn, how do I work with someone that's got a mental health condition, then I've got a peds 2 hours later, then I'm going to see an adult with a physical impairment, someone needs a report, someone needs this sort of assistive technology prescription, everybody needs something different in their the conditions of the people that you're working with, particularly in a lot of the community-based sort of general roles, they often do take on a little bit of everything. So that's probably the biggest challenge, is that managing that diversity and feeling like you know what you're doing, I suppose, because you're doing so much of everything. You can get 6 months in and still feel like you don't really know what you're doing because you've only done a little bit of everything. Where if you compare that to maybe a hospital role, where you've been in ortho for 6 months seeing people that have had hip replacements, you do the same thing over and over and over, lots of repetition, lots of opportunity to feel competent or confident. Obviously, the range of the skills that you've developed are a lot more narrow probably compared to what others in a more varied community NDIS role may have started to develop, but you're probably going to get to that feeling of competence in that little skill set a lot quicker than maybe somebody that's trying to learn a lot of everything all at once.
Mm-hmm. And then on top of the clinical component, you're more than likely working to billable hours.
Yeah, and I suppose there's some companies that have sort of tried to work their systems to keep those hours, as low as possible for early career clinicians or sort of in a graduated build-up. But the reality is that salary expectations are quite high and the NDIS sort of hourly rate that we can charge hasn't gone up for years. So it's a very difficult balance for businesses to be able to, keep KPIs low while matching the salary expectations and still breaking even or, dare I say, make a profit. But that's sort of a, secondary goal often for a lot of businesses at the moment that are just trying to get by. So,
and working to billable hours is a skill in itself, isn't it? Like you need to learn how to manage your time, document your billing. It's another added layer to what you're already doing clinically.
Yeah.
And then the report writing, especially for OTs in the NDIS, is quite complex.
It's complex, and I think it's potentially frustrating as well, just in terms of particularly in recent years there's been trends towards OTs just having a feeling that we put all these hours into writing these reports and either they're not read or the person that's judging our clinical reasoning has no disability training and is questioning things that, we're trying to explain things to people that, haven't had the same qualifications and training, and that can be quite frustrating for OTs. So besides the complexity of the fact that NDIS writing is different and long, and if you've seen some of the NDIS templates, when you have to use those, they can be quite repetitive. And again, what exactly am I needing to write in this? What do they want? They've already asked me that three times. How do I write that differently? So, It is a challenge, but it's a skill to learn in itself. And it's another thing, though, that even though you feel like you're learning this really specific skill set, there are still underlying steps of report writing that you can then transfer to, go work with a different funding body. It's still those steps of finding out what's the purpose of the report. What does the referrer want from this? And am I managing their expectations? What audience am I writing for? What format are they expecting? So you still needed to learn all those steps. And that you can then transfer to a different, funding body or a different type of report you might need to write one day. But yeah, it is an art and a bit of a challenge to learn.
Yeah, and I guess too, working in a hospital role, you're not working to a scheme, are you? You're working to a scheme in the NDIS, and again, that's another thing that you need to get your head around and need to learn the systems. And then one other thing I was going to mention is working quite autonomously out in the community in someone's home as an early career therapist. It can be quite daunting to think, but what happens if I don't know what to do? What do I do if I get into a challenging situation? Just another added layer, isn't it? On top of working to a scheme, your report writing, working to billable hours, the clinical knowledge that you need to have.
No, and that's sort of, again, it's the sort of the flip side of the freedom of being out on the road and not stuck in an office or a hospital building. Yeah, you're out doing things, seeing people. You can stop at a cafe, stop at a beach and write some notes, but the flip side is you are on your own a lot of the time. So it's all fine. Probably 95% of the time things go to plan. There's no unexpected things, but I've been speaking with some other senior OTs where things haven't gone to plan and they haven't been prepared adequately in terms of sort of what would you do in this situation. Even just knowing that if you're not comfortable, it is okay to leave. You don't have to stay in that situation and try and find your way out. You kind of, make that judgment call of, is it worth me staying here or is it okay to leave? That's the thing with community practice. It's not like you only got one shot at ever seeing this person. It generally is okay to leave and make a plan to come back and continue that assessment after you've had time to touch base with somebody that can tell you what should you be doing next. So,
It's having the confidence to make those calls, isn't it? And that experience. So we've dissected out how complex this role is. And what is so obvious is that we really need to be supporting all OTs working in the NDIS, but in particular, we really need to be supporting our early career OTs. In your opinion, what should support and education look like for early career OTs in everyday practice?
Good question. And I suppose the ideal of what we're aiming for is often a lot harder for company owners and managers to deliver in practice. But probably going back to the start of when managers are actually trying to recruit OTs, recruiting with the priority that they will need to sort of make this supervision available to their OTs and also for the new grads that are signing up to jobs to try and prioritize those sorts of roles. Those company owners that have, really crunched the numbers and done their best to deliver supervision, they're the ones we need to really be, going for, because they're the ones that those sorts of roles are the ones where OTs tend to be lasting longer and they feel a lot more confident. So that supervision in terms of what it looks like, it needs to be a mix of, formal supervision. So OT Australia does have a supervision framework with lots of evidence-based sort of guidelines and suggestions for, what it can look like, how you record it and those sorts of things. But in general, we're aiming for probably at least an hour of formal supervision each week. But really often the more important support is coming from that ad hoc support each day, where they've just got, particularly those first few months where you're just trying to work out all the rules, the processes that you need to follow. If you're saving that up to the end of the week when you've got a formal supervision session, it really slows you down in terms of the progress that you can make. Whereas if you just had someone available each day to answer 10 minutes worth of questions of those little things, you can really speed things along. So I think a lot of company owners that maybe don't have a senior OT available to provide that really formal supervision think, yep, I can get some external supervision, that's no problem. And there are plenty of external supervising OTs offering their services. But it's also thinking about that, what's that ad hoc option that they've got?
And what about external, if you're with a company that's got a great induction program, really good weekly supervision. Do you think there's a need for, say, grad OTs to be sort like using a professional development budget to attend external courses or?
Yeah, I think so, because it's one of those things where you can just not just one strict way of doing anything OT wise. There's so many different approaches that you can take to solving the same problem. So, you can learn very much from your one supervisor, but sometimes, there's real more like the specialty skills that rather than the supervisor's time being spent, 5 hours, 4 hours teaching you this one skill, the fundamentals, you can learn from somebody as somebody else, and then take that what you learned back to your supervision sessions and discuss and get a few different viewpoints of, how you can tackle a particular situation that you're working within. But also for the company itself, that outsourcing can sometimes be a much more efficient use of time in terms of instead of having your senior sitting there teaching maybe like lectures or tutorials once a week for a few hours and having to actually develop those, that content, which as an educator, I know like it takes time to do that. They could actually outsource that, and it's actually works out more efficient for everybody, more cost effective, and their seniors can then dedicate their time to doing that really individualized one-on-one support rather than that, just day-to-day teaching. So I definitely think there's a that there is, even if you've got supervisors available, you're doing shadowing, having that external supervision has benefits for the clinician themselves, but also the actual team and the supervisors.
And Claire, what do you think an induction program should look like?
So again,
Big question.
there's the ideal, and then there's what in reality is going to work. So I mean, ideally, having reduced KPI, so that graduated KPI approach, so that there is plenty of space within their day between appointments to really reflect on what they're doing. So there's as an early career clinician, there's so much unbillable time. Really, we can't really bill for our time as we're trying to learn about this diagnosis that we've never heard before, or trying to learn about the NDIS AT process. What form do I fill in for this particular thing I need to order? Those sort of things just need time and space, so that you're not feeling that you've still got to punch out, your normal KPI that someone that's been working in the NDIS for 3 or 4 years is able to achieve. There's just so much learning time, so there needs to be space for that, so that people are doing that learning in work hours without having to do it after hours, I suppose. We've also touched on the supervision, so you need the ad hoc and the formal, having some sort of external or in-house regular CPD as well. But even just as part of that, like a case conferencing type approach. Maybe that's me learning from the hospital system side of things, where case conferencing was a weekly thing. But there's so much value in just being able to sit down and share, not just with your supervisor, but maybe with your team around you. You've got this tricky case coming up. What are your suggestions? What have you found work and sort of that benefit of shared learning? Particularly if there's more than one new grad at once, having that peer learning approach can be really valuable as well.
And I mean, I think in OT is so broad, and a common theme that we always hear is that it's overwhelming. It's so easy to get overwhelmed in our profession because there is so much to know across the lifespan. For OTs that are feeling overwhelmed out in the community, do you think it's okay for them to ask to bring their caseload in, maybe don't work across the lifespan, just go with an adult caseload, or just go with a pediatric caseload? Do you think that's a sensible thing for people to do?
And this is one of those things where the ideal would be that, would be sort of trying to take it back to a bit more of a restricted caseload. But in reality, I also understand that, companies may not have that amount of ability to pick and choose from the referrals that they're getting. But definitely there needs to be some space as part of an early career clinician's onboarding that they can say no to referrals that are just completely beyond what they should be learning. So if, as a new grad, you shouldn't be taking an SDA report type referral. That's a whole nother level of report compared to our normal ones. You shouldn't be really tackling a complex wheelchair prescription by yourself when you barely know how to, feel confident prescribing some basic bathroom equipment. So those sorts of things, that's something that definitely is a bit more within probably a company's ability to manage and to at least say no to those really complex referrals. But if before they're even recruiting an OT, they can try and see what flexibility they've got coming in within their referrals to be able to say, okay, we're going to just give you referrals for people with physical impairments, or we're going to just give you referrals for people who are autistic, or even we're just going to give you referrals for FCAs. So you're not having to do all the ongoing skill building and goal setting and all that sort of thing. We're just going to do the one-off assessments reports, one-off assessment report, until you get really confident with that. Because there may not be that ability to really hone in on just one particular diagnosis, but that's definitely something that, you know, the ideal would be, I think, that it has worked well, and the companies that are the smaller teams that I work with and have successfully sort of onboarded their new grads that way by really triaging what referrals they give them and when they give them those sorts of referrals to step them up and build up their competencies.
And when it comes to interviews, Claire, what are the key questions that early career therapists should be asking a potential employer about the role in terms of support, supervision, professional development? What do you think the key questions are when the interview flips and it's you as a therapist interviewing a potential employer as to, you know, what's in this role for you and is this the best role for you?
Yeah, and I think it's probably very different to what it looked like 10 years ago where you'd be too scared and they say, your turn for questions, what would you like to ask? No, thanks, I'm fine, I'm happy with that. Just please employ me. Whereas now it's kind of like they're expecting it. So I think that's something important for early career clinicians to know. And the good companies that have nothing to hide, that are really proud of their onboarding and have put the work in, will be able to answer confidently and will welcome the questions. So because they'll know that then you're, you know, trying to do the best to not just worry about negotiating the best salary, but you're actually trying to find something that's going to support you. So that would be the first thing, is don't be scared to ask these questions. Mm-hmm. But I'd be asking things like, yeah, all the things we've basically covered of what should be in an onboarding. So sometimes I'll have it written down on a nice bit of paper, but you might ask for them to give you a little bit more logistics. So, you know, week one, how many patients or how many clients do you think I would be seeing in a typical day? And that's going to be different whether you're community-based or clinic-based. Or it could be, you know, what's your in-house education program? How many sort of, for the clinicians that you've got working now, how many hours do they spend either meeting with each other for learning or going to external courses, and actually see if they can give you numbers. But the other thing that I'd suggest is to see if they're happy for you to speak with some of their other staff members, because again, if they're doing a good job and they've got nothing to hide, their staff members will be willing to talk to you and to say exactly whether what you know, on paper comes up in their perks package in their job advertisement is actually a reality, and what you can expect to see. So yeah, just being brave to ask those questions.
Yeah, absolutely. So Claire, just in wrapping up, what support and resources can OTs access through your OT tutor?
Probably in terms of the whole job searching thing, I did create a workbook which is available for free on my website, and it basically takes people through like a five-step process of all these things you need to consider when you're trying to decide what job is for you. So starting way back at, for the early career clinicians, what did I like about my placements? What didn't I like and why? And using that to actually inform where should I start my first role, and what am I going to like about it, I suppose. And then all those different other factors you need to consider about, you know, are you going to prioritise the salary or the flexibility in the hours or the caseload or the supervision, juggling all those things, plus all the different steps, including reaching out to recruiters as well so that they can help guide you if it all just becomes way too much, which particularly at the moment when there's so many job offers, it can be hard to even cull it down enough to make a start and put an application in. So I do recommend that, yeah, recruiters can be a valuable resource, and it doesn't cost anything to the clinician. So that's something as well to not be scared of, that you're going to get a big bill at the end because you've spent half an hour on the phone getting some advice. So yeah, doing all those sorts of things. So that's in a workbook that's on my website. And there's a little webinar recording to go along with it where I shared my tips. But there's lots of other things on my website. If you find yourself in the NDIS role and you're wanting a little bit of extra support, a lot of my courses and resources have been developed with early career clinicians or anyone really new to the NDIS in mind. So lots of things that you can have a look at.
Mm-hmm. And is LinkedIn the best place to see all your content, Claire? I know that's where I see it all.
Yeah, yep. So technically I'm on Facebook and Instagram, but I don't really, you know, maximize my content for the algorithm, I'd say, on those sorts of things. So sometimes I forget to put a post up there for a few days. So, but whereas LinkedIn, yep, if you want all my free tips and posts, following me on LinkedIn is where you'll see something pretty much most days.
Fantastic. And obviously people can get in touch via LinkedIn. Any other ways to get in touch?
Yep, just via the website, there's a, you know, an inquiry form you can put in. My email is on there as well. If you do want to chat on the phone, it's fine as well.
Fantastic. Claire, thanks so much for joining us today. The support, the resources that are on offer are just really critical to what OTs need at the moment. So well done.
Thank you so much, and thanks so much for having me. Like following your stuff as well, and you'll be anyone that's following me on LinkedIn will find a lot more MediRecruit stuff popping up as well that I've come across as you guys are sharing things. So all about, collaborating with other OTs doing great things. So yeah, thanks so much for having me on.
Thanks, Claire.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed listening to the Allied Health Podcast. To listen to new episodes, please subscribe via Apple, Google, or wherever you find your favourite podcasts. And if you've enjoyed the show, please give it a 5-star rating and review, and be sure to tell your therapy colleagues and friends to tune in.